to Red Eyes Radio. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik Palmgren. I'm from Sweden, and this is an independent radio program that is all about finding answers, truthful answers, that is based on what really is happening in our world. We question official history and the mainstream view, but also much of what comes from the alternatives. Today we have one of those other impossible tasks ahead of us, trying to counter the character assassination and crook image that the media has built of former President of the United States, Richard Nixon. That's right, Mr. Tricky Dicky, who has developed into an iconic, almost archetypal image of the worst possible politician imaginable throughout all times. Well, you know, we're doing everything we can to go against the grain, right? Question your heroes and uplift your villains. No, but seriously, we want to know, is this an accurate image of Richard Nixon, or should we question the historians and the media's treatment of him, just as we've learned to question the media itself? If you're familiar with the media's techniques, you've come to realize that they do shape our worldview, and they provide us with the villains, the victims, and also the heroes, like it was a screenplay directly out of the nightmare factories of Hollywood. Saddam, Gaddafi, even Putin, right? I mean, that doesn't mean that these people are saints, but it means that they were doing something that the establishment didn't or doesn't like, and they decided to take them up. In some cases, even to a shearing world, screaming for their heads to be served on a silver platter. This is all based on information that they've gotten from the mainstream media. Now, if those accusations that made these people fall are based on falsehood, then it becomes quite scary, doesn't it? Now, I'm not one who's much for trying to save the reputation of any politician. I wish there were more good ones, but I think they are almost across the board, at least these days, part of seedy activities. There are opportunists, populists, and they do what they can to get ahead and make it in a corrupt world of blackmail and backstabbing. But despite that, I'd say that there are a few good alternatives in Europe these days that actually are for the European peoples, and they are anti-European Union, they're anti-centralization, they're against the way that these governments are completely running over the wishes of the people. But look at how they are portrayed in the media. This is my point. They're showing them as there's some kind of reincarnation of Hitler or something, you know, completely childish or stupid like that. So you do have that, but the point here then, the objective here is more to show that there is not much difference between the politicians that we're offered, you know, as the okay alternatives to vote on that will save us from the horrors of daily life. There have been a few, I think, that were truly anti-global establishment and anti-banking power, but those have been dealt with and vilified by history to such an extent that many do not dare look their way, much less even speak their names. It's not always true, but often the most demonized persons have actually been attempting to do something that stands in the way of the establishment's plan for more control and domination. I mean, think about it. If we can agree at least that the current climate of elitism and the small seedy clique of those who own the media that want to control our opinions and ultimately the very foundation of how we live our lives and shape our worldview, well, then we have to question the information they are giving us and question the information they are leaving out and ask why some are portrayed like saints and others like devils when it's clear that it might be a complete reversal of the reality. Well, this might or might not be true of Nixon, but I think it is of others. But what's rare about Nixon is that he is the one president that has been painted probably as the most corrupt in modern history by our media. Where there is smoke, there usually is fire. I get that, but what annoys me in this situation is that despite his level of crookery, it seems to pale in comparison to that of Bill Clinton, George Bush, and certainly Barack Hussein Obama. Even to the shenanigans of the Kennedys, Nixon's tricks seems fairly innocent. Yet the narrative is very much controlled. We do get a very regulated, kosher view from the press. Well, we can't allow ourselves to be fooled and shaped by those who seek to turn people into useful idiots and have us fight their wars for them, right? So with that having been said, let's talk with someone who's actually been on the inside, who knew Nixon. Our guest is Roger Stone, described by the New York Times' Maureen Dowd as the keeper of the Nixon flame. He was the youngest member of the Nixon staff in 1972 and worked closely with Nixon on his rehabilitation in his post-presidential years. He has been a Washington insider for the last 40 years and played a key role in the election of Republican President Nixon and Ronald Reagan. His book on Lyndon B. Johnson was the second best-selling book during the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. We'll talk about some of that later in the program, but we'll begin to discuss his latest book on Nixon's secrets, Watergate, and the pardon. Well, good day, Mr. Stone. Thank you for coming on the program with us. It's good to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
I am delighted to be here.
Thank you. Now, the book is Nixon's Secrets, The Rise, Fall, and Untold Truth About the President, Watergate, and the pardon. It's a really interesting book, has a lot of information in it, and I think you offer a perspective that we seldom hear about, because at least from my perspective, it feels like Nixon has to be one of the most demonized presidents in, well, at least recent modern American history, if you will. But tell us a little bit about your background first. You were an aide at the White House. You did work under Nixon, I believe, a little bit later after the presidency. You got to know him more personally. But how did you end up writing the book, and what's your background on this?
Well, I'm a veteran of eight national Republican presidential campaigns, starting in 1968 all the way through the George W. Bush campaign. So I have spent 40 years in the corroded rectum of the two-party system. And during that experience, I kind of learned that the version of things given to you by the U.S. government is rarely the truth. Whether you are talking about the Bay of Pigs invasion or the Cuban Missile Crisis or Watergate or the Kennedy assassination or Obamacare or ISIS or the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life, very seldom are the American people told the complete truth about these seminal events. And I think that the politics of the 1960s and 70s, really starting with the federal government's secret plans to assassinate Castro, brings us through a list of cataclysmic events that include not only the mafia CIA plots to kill Castro, but the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the rise of the Great Society, the Watergate scandal, the pardon. These are all interrelated historical events. So what I have tried to do in this book, Nixon Secrets, which is really a sequel to my previous book, which is called The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, is to connect dots for my readers so they can see the totality of history. I had direct access to four American presidents. I was a Washington insider for 40 years. I was a very active and prominent member of the Republican Party, former member of the Republican National Committee Executive Committee. I'm actually a former Young Republican National Chairman. Today, I'm not even in the Republican Party. I left the Republican Party of the Bushes and the Romneys behind. I'm a member of the Libertarian Party, which is a small party in our country that is committed to the Constitution and freedom and truth. And we don't have very many electoral prospects, but at least I can sleep at night.
Well, I want to ask you more about that later, because we definitely need to get into this, debate talking more about the two-party system and how to get something else in there, basically, in American politics. Seems very difficult, but we'll save some of that for later. Now, before we proceed, how much power would you say that the president really holds? I mean, we've talked quite extensively about that on this program and talked about how many advisors there are around them. A lot of people are pulling the strings. A lot of things, at least in my view, makes it just quite clear that the president is only the face, really, and they don't hold that much power. You've been working closely with a lot of them. What would you say about that?
I think they hold a lot of power. The point you're making, I think, is they don't hold all the power, and therefore one must always make a corrupt bargain to become president. Clearly, during Nixon's presidency, he was at odds with the Central Intelligence Agency from the beginning. Nixon knew the Central Intelligence Agency played a role in the murder of Kennedy. Nixon sought from the minute he was elected president to get proof of that. He kept demanding the CIA turn over to the chief executive records of the Kennedy assassination, and they flatly refused. We now know those records had actually been destroyed, unbeknownst to Nixon. So I really think the Nixon administration, to a great extent, was undermined by the hardliners in the Central Intelligence Agency, in the Pentagon, in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in Army Intelligence, because with the election of Nixon, they thought they had the ultimate hardliner. They were shocked when he decided to withdraw American troops from Vietnam. They were aghast when they found out that he had opened back-channel secret negotiations to normalize relations with the Chinese. They were outraged when he was able to broker deep arms control agreements from the Soviets. Nixon became an advocate for peace, and that wasn't in their plan. And therefore, I make the case in my book, the Central Intelligence Agency made plans to kill Nixon just as they had killed Kennedy. They had certainly played a role in the death of Kennedy. And there were two failed assassination attempts on Nixon, both in Miami, Florida. One in which the Central Intelligence Agency planned to infiltrate an anti-war demonstration outside the home, outside the presidential compound in Key Biscayne, Florida, and to use a shoulder-launched rocket to kill Nixon. That plot collapsed. And then there was a secondary plot in which Frank Sturgis, a CIA operative, soldier of fortune, ironically one of the men later arrested in the Watergate burglary, went out and recruited a contract killer, Ed Kaiser, who had killed for the Central Intelligence Agency before, to shoot Nixon as he emerged from a speech to the veterans of foreign wars. That plot collapsed when Kaiser refused to pull the trigger. When it was revealed to Kaiser who the target was, he withdrew. Fast forward to 1972, the Central Intelligence Agency learns about the plans to break into the Watergate by some of the bumblers around Nixon, which is a domestic political plot, and they infiltrate and sabotage the Watergate break-in in order to gain leverage over Nixon, who is demanding that the Central Intelligence Agency turn over the Kennedy assassination records, but more precisely, in order to end détente, the Nixon-Kissinger program for détente is anathema to the hardliners. Today we call them neocons. I found actual documentations in doing research for my book. The Central Intelligence Agency believed Dr. Henry Kissinger was actually a Soviet agent.
Really?
They believed he was an active member of the Soviet conspiracy. So there was very little trust. Within Nixon's own government. He wasn't in control of his own government, as Kennedy was not in control of his government. And to a certain extent, Lyndon Johnson was not in control of his government.
Yeah, what a scenario. There seems to be so many different agendas and things that occur at the same time here. Now, let's just back up a little bit here, Dan, because a great portion of our audience is younger. They might not remember everything about the Watergate scandal, but this is one of those events where we've gotten tons of different theories and reason why it occurred. It kind of seems to have spiraled out of control to a certain extent. But can you break it down for us a little bit and what you explain it from your point of view of what really happened here and why it happened the way it did?
Well, in 1972, Richard Nixon, who was a very polarizing and controversial figure throughout his entire career, Americans either really liked him or they really hated him. There was nobody in the middle. He had a tumultuous career. He was counted out politically at least three times, left for dead, completely finished. But with an enormous amount of perspicacity and tenaciousness, and a real persistence and resilience, he would ultimately become president. In 1960, he ran for president against John F. Kennedy, who was a very charismatic, figure, and Kennedy really used the early techniques of Madison Avenue and American advertising to build a public image of him, for example, as a great family man. He was a notorious philanderer.
Yep.
As a great senator, he was kind of a lightweight playboy senator with not many legislative accomplishments to his name. And as a real cold warrior, he actually outflanked Nixon in the presidential election, like I said, running to Nixon's right, saying that Nixon and Eisenhower weren't tough enough on the commies, which is interesting. And they went to a very, very close, hard-fought election for the presidency. The seeds of Watergate are really sown in the 1960 election, even though Watergate doesn't happen until 1972. In essence, although he makes a number of very early mistakes in that campaign, for example, Nixon agrees to four televised debates with the lesser-known Kennedy. Kennedy realizes that those televised debates will be judged not on substance, but on appearance and on style. So I think I could suggest Nixon should never have agreed to the debates to begin with, because they had the effect of just elevating Kennedy to the same level as an eight-year vice president who was far better known and at that point more respected than Kennedy. But then bad luck intervenes. Nixon bumps his knee on a car door. His knee becomes infected. He has to be hospitalized with intravenous antibiotics for 2 weeks. He comes out of the hospital underweight, exhausted, still running a fever, still on antibiotics. He rushes to Chicago for their first televised debate. Because he's trying to make up for lost ground, he hits five states on his way to Chicago. When he gets there, he looks like walking death. Kennedy gets to Chicago a day early. He spends his day on the roof getting a suntan of the hotel, the roof of the hotel, getting a suntan with two hookers. Even Nixon writes in his biography he'd never seen Kennedy looking so fit. The famous author Theodore White writes in his book, Kennedy entered the studio looking like a bronzed god. The first debate was a disaster. It is interesting that those who heard the debate on the radio thought Nixon had prevailed, but those who saw the debate on television overwhelmingly thought that Kennedy had prevailed. Anyway, there were three more debates. Those three debates, the next two debates, did not have as large a television audience as the first, but a much greater television audience, the fourth debate, the foreign policy debate, by all estimations, Nixon's strongest debate, had a television audience that was as great as the first debate. There's a lot of evidence that Nixon hoarded his money for the last 30 days, so he actually outspent the fabulously wealthy Kennedys on television and radio in the last 30 days. And Eisenhower, the president at that time, immensely popular American president, comes off the bench, campaigns aggressively for Nixon in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York, and Los Angeles. The bottom line is that Nixon won the 1960 election narrowly. He came back from a number of very early egregious errors to win. And then on election night, with help from organized crime, with help from the mob, this election was stolen from him. Stolen in the wards of Chicago, which flipped the state of Illinois, and stolen by John Kennedy's running mate, Lyndon Baines Johnson, in New York, where thousands of votes were thrown out, the legitimate votes for Nixon were thrown out, and those ballots were immediately burned, so there could be no recount. In 1960, Texas had no recount. So the resentment of Richard Nixon, the bitterness, the heavy-handedness of the 1972 campaign and Watergate is born in the frustration and resentment of the fact that the 1960 election was stolen by John F. Kennedy and his millionaire gangster father, Ambassador Joseph B. Kennedy Sr.
Well, it's very interesting here. I mean, in terms of how it's portrayed today, it's a very, very binary view, of course. We have the Nixon, or Nixon versus the Kennedys. It's kind of like, you know, Darth Vader versus Luke Skywalker, in a way. The Kennedys are portrayed as saintly that are coming along to save America. And as you said, a lot of this is based on Madison Avenue techniques, of course. But would you say that Nixon is the most demonized president in modern history?
Oh, there's no question. He is totally polarized. By the end of his presidency, he can count on support from neither the left nor the right. He is vilified in America, beginning in 1947, when, as a member of the House, the Congress, he pursued an investigation into Alger Hiss, who was accused of being a Soviet spy. Alger Hiss was a very high-level advisor to Presidents Truman and Roosevelt. He was a Harvard graduate. He belonged to the best clubs. He was truly a member of the intellectual and political elite. Ultimately, Nixon would prove that Hiss was lying about his espionage activities, and Hiss would go to prison for perjury. 40 years later, when the Soviet Union fell and Americans got access to KGB documents, we found out that Nixon was absolutely right. Hiss was, in fact, the highest-ranking Soviet spy in the United States. But the mass media really resented Nixon's pursuit of Hiss, and from that time forward, he never was treated particularly well. But you're absolutely right. The idea of the Kennedys as dashing, charming, sophisticates, and Richard Nixon is kind of the square, middle-class, boring everyman, is the narrative. Here is the truth. John F. Kennedy was a methamphetamine addict. He was functional only with daily injections of methamphetamine, a proprietary formula, where he was being injected by Dr. Max Jacobson. Jacobson would later lose his medical license for the use of methamphetamine. There was a giant struggle among President Kennedy's doctors, his mainstream doctors, Dr. Janet Travell, and a Dr. Cohn struggled mightily to get Jacobson away from the president. On the eve of the famous Nixon-Kennedy presidential debate, when John Kennedy needed a little jolt of energy, he actually got an injection in his voice box from Dr. Jacobson. On the eve of the Kennedy-Khrushchev debate at the summit in Vienna, we know historically as a negotiating technique, Khrushchev kept Kennedy waiting for hours. The problem with that is that Kennedy's methamphetamine injection kept wearing off. He didn't have, as he put it, his edge. The doctor injected him 3 times. Is it any wonder that Khrushchev took the young and callow Kennedy to the cleaners at that summit? So the story of the Kennedys is much more interesting and much more evil than the American people have been told. Kennedy's methamphetamine habit and the documentation of it is, of course, all in my book.
Well, the Kennedys' background is very interesting in how they ended up being so powerful, eventually placing one of their own in the White House. But many of the things Nixon was accused of, specifically during the Watergate scandal, were things that the Kennedys themselves actually did to Nixon. They wiretapped him. They broke into his, you know, to get his medical records and things like this, right?
Yes. I mean, look, American politics is not and never has been beanbagged. In the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, both parties tapped each other, spied on each other. Huge all cash corporate contributions were the rule of the day. The mob was a major player in American politics. They financed the career of Adlai Stevenson. They financed the career of Lyndon Johnson. They financed the career of John Kennedy, and they financed the career of Richard Nixon. There were no campaign finance laws. Everything was done on the basis of cash. Yes, the Kennedys broke into and wiretapped Nixon's hotel on the eve of the second Kennedy-Nixon debate. Yes. They had somebody break into his doctor's office and steal his medical records in New York City. Yes, somebody broke into Nixon's accountant's office to steal his financial records. These things were all ordered by Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was, as Nixon said in his biography, a real SOB. And the Kennedys were the most ruthless political operators he'd ever come across. He vowed after the 1960 election that he would never be outdone by them again. He would never be out-hustled again. And that, I think, breeds the tactics of Watergate. But the idea that break-ins and illegal contributions and wiretapping, that these are limited to Nixon, is nonsense. They were the norm in American politics. In my book, Nixon's Secrets, I merely seek to put Nixon in the context of his times. I do not argue he's an angel. I don't argue that he's perfect. I think he's very great and very flawed. He's both brilliant and obtuse. He's both bold and hesitant. He's both confident and paranoid. He's all of these things at the same time, but he's also the most durable political figure of the 20th century. He revives his career after the narrow loss to Kennedy, which he compounds by running for governor of his native California in an attempt to remain relevant, a race in which he loses at the last minute because the Cuban Missile Crisis breaks just weeks before the election. And, of course, the American people have a tendency to rally around the president and his party at time of international crisis. Nixon is once again cheated out of victory in an election in which he led in the early polls. So by 1963, he's dead, finished, washed up. Yesterday's news, he's actually kind of a national joke. It is only the murder of John Kennedy that has the inadvertent effect of breathing life back into the political career and presidential prospects of Richard Nixon.
A lot of people question the motives of all presidents for good reason and whatnot, but from your point of view, would you say that Nixon was a patriot that had the best interest of America at heart?
I think that he had a very progressive domestic agenda, and he had a long string of accomplishments. Let's look at them for a moment. He withdrew American troops from the Kennedy-Johnson war in Vietnam over the objections of the Pentagon. Yes, he greatly increased the bombing, but he did that as a cover for withdrawal of American men and women. He opened the door to China over the objections of his own foreign policy apparatus. He then used the new relationship with China to pressure the Soviets into arms control agreements. He desegregated the public schools without violence or bloodshed. The desegregation in America doesn't take place under Kennedy or Johnson. It takes place under Nixon. He gave us the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, the 18-year-old vote. He ends the military draft for 18-year-old males. He launches the war on cancer. So his is a very progressive and peace-oriented policy. He's a very successful president from that point of view. Sadly, all of that is erased in the ashes of Watergate. Nixon, Watergate, Nixon, Watergate. Not Nixon peacemaker, but Nixon, Watergate. It's why the man is he's a Greek tragedy. He was a very, I think, progressive and successful presidency, and all of that is obscured by his mistakes in Watergate.
Tell us about some of the other people around this as well, Watergate. You know, Gordon Liddy, we have, obviously, tell us more about John Dean and his involvement in this as well.
Sure. I mean, you asked the best question is, what was Watergate really about? And that is, of course, even today, a mystery. Let's figure out that in June of 1972, at the time that some of Nixon's men broke into the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate complex, Nixon was leading his opponent, George McGovern, by 19 points nationally on his way to a 49-state blowout. So there is no good, logical, political reason to take the risk of breaking into the Watergate. I think that there are several things going on at the same time in terms of the Watergate break-in. First of all, the man who plans, pushes, and covers up the Watergate is John Dean. Mr. Dean has been lying about this for 40 years. The Watergate break-in is his baby. How do we know this? Well, two highly decorated New York police officers who are working for the White House as investigators both say in their memoirs and in subsequent questioning that John Dean ordered them to case out the Watergate building 6 weeks before the first break-in. Watergate burglar James W. McCord tells the grand jury that it was Dean who planned the Watergate. Jeb Magruder, who was the director of Nixon's reelection campaign and got mired in Watergate, he testifies to the Senate committee and to the Watergate prosecutors. It was Dean who pushed the break-in of the Watergate. What does Dean want in the Watergate? It's very simple. It's not even politics. It's about sex. Dean wants to recover the records of a call girl ring that is being used by the Democrats for assignations with high-level visiting Democrats who come to Washington. He either wants that information for the purposes of blackmail, but more precisely, I think he wants that information because his wife is intimately involved with this call girl ring, as is he. 15 years ago, when Len Kolodny wrote that in a book, Dean sued him. Dean now runs around saying he won that suit. He didn't win that suit. That suit wasn't even settled. That suit was withdrawn. And Kolodny's book is still on the market. Now a new book, a stunning new book called White House Call Girl by Phil Stanford fills in a lot of blanks with new documents.
Yeah, we had
Dean ordered the Watergate. Dean covered up the Watergate. Mr. Dean himself now has a book out called The Nixon Defense, in which he claims it is the definitive book on Watergate. But what I have learned is that he's airbrushed himself out of that narrative as if he wasn't even there. He doesn't tell you that he was the one who dangled executive clemency in front of the Watergate burglars, that he is the one who ordered the case out of the Watergate facility before the break-in, that he was the one who destroyed the contents of Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt's safe. He justifies this by saying, those who want to know what my role was should read my book, Blind Ambition. But when questioned under oath about the discrepancies between Blind Ambition and his sworn testimony, Dean said he didn't write Blind Ambition. He says that Taylor Branch, his ghostwriter, wrote it. Then he changed the story and said that his editor at Random House, Alice Mayhew, wrote it. By the way, they both deny that in my book. And in fact, even though he says his book is definitive and that it's based on 363 new transcripts of taped conversations, he won't make those transcripts public. Here's what I can tell you. He omits his conversations with Nixon of March 13th, 16th, 17th, and 20th from his book. If you read those transcripts or listen to those tapes, you hear John Dean urging Nixon to commit crimes. You hear John Dean sucking Nixon into the cover-up. A week ago at the Texas Book Festival, I confronted Dean, and he threatened to sue me. I welcome this lawsuit. I'm anxious for this lawsuit. You know why? Because truth is the ultimate defense.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, this is very interesting. So what's your take on that? And tell us a bit more about the background, the reasoning behind all this, because we have a lot of players involved who are not only, you know, seeking, you know, power, of course, but there's a lot of personal gain in politics, and we have the mob being very strong at the time, and at the same time, we have CIA operating and doing their own kind of activities and shenanigans. But is there really anyone pulling the definitive strings here? There just seems to be so much different objectives and power-hungry factions here that are trying to gain power. Is there anyone really in charge?
Yeah, this is almost like a Keystone Cops movie because there's so many things going on at the same time. First of all, John Dean, Jeb Magruder, and Gordon Liddy are trying to break into the Watergate, and I think their interest is in securing the records of the call girl ring, specifically a portfolio with pictures of the women that you can choose for your nightly companion. That's what they're after. One of the Watergate burglars, Eugenio Martinez, is arrested with the key to the desk drawer where that portfolio is kept. By the way, Martinez is on the payroll of the CIA at the time of the break-in. The CIA, to the contrary, they learn about the Dean Magruder Liddy plan, and therefore they infiltrate. Once Watergate burglars E. Howard Hunt and James McCord are recruited for the break-in team, the CIA is now at the table. Those men are both still working for the CIA and reporting to case officers. So now the CIA is inside the plot, and they see their opportunity to bring Nixon down, to end détente, end these crazy peace proposals, end his soft line towards the Soviets and the Chinese.
Mm.
Indeed, the whole idea here is, with the succession of Ford, détente is done. Henry Kissinger maintains his title as Secretary of State under Ford, but power shifts to Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy, Dick Cheney, the White House Chief of Staff, and then later the Secretary of Defense. Détente is over, and the CIA, with the removal of Nixon, achieves their goals. Many on the left could not remove Nixon at the ballot box. Therefore, they had to remove him in a coup d'etat. Now, that's not to say that Nixon didn't fall of his own hand, because when he learned about the Watergate break-in, regardless of what the reason was or the goal was, he should have fired everyone involved.
Right.
Instead, he instinctively covered up, and that was the beginning of the end. It wasn't his involvement. He didn't know about the break-in in advance. It was the cover-up that brought him down. So why we say in American politics, it's not the crime that gets you, it's the cover-up.
Yeah, exactly. Let me ask you a little bit more about, you know, the detente and what happened with Soviet and U.S. relations around, you know, this period as well, and how you view, let's say, Soviet infiltration of you know, American politics and everything, and how real that is. Because, again, just like kind of this Nixon view that people have, they view McCarthyism as some kind of, you know, crazy kook that's just running around that's paranoid and there's nothing to it. But was there a real threat at the time from Soviet infiltration, and were they smart to be paranoid about all of this, do you think?
No, there's no question. There's a terrific book called Blacklisted by History by M. Stanton Evans,
yes,
which I think makes an authoritative case that the threat of Soviet infiltration of our government during the Roosevelt and Truman administrations was very real. Our nuclear secrets were being stolen by Soviet agents. Among the liberals populating the State Department and the diplomatic corps were many Soviet moles. Nixon forged his teeth politically on anti-communism. As we discussed, he was the man who nailed the Soviet spy Alger Hiss. So this is why the neocons, the hardliners, really thought Nixon would be very pliable as president. Nixon was a realist. He realized the war in Vietnam was fruitless, that we were spending American lives and treasure in an endeavor that we could not win. He also understood that it was foolish to leave a nation of millions and their markets, the Chinese, out in the cold. He realized that the Soviets were more concerned about the Chinese than us, and therefore if he opened the door to China, he could play the Chinese and the Russians off against each other to the benefit of the United States.
Yeah.
He rewrote our entire geopolitical strategy. Get your two biggest enemies to fight among themselves. That's genius. And the arms control reductions he got from the Soviets saved this country hundreds of millions of dollars and made for a much, much safer world. So I do think that there was a legitimate threat of domestic communism, subversion in this country. I think that McCarthy was on to something. His tactics were sloppy, there's no question. But it's hard to come up with the name of all these people he ruined, all the innocent people he ruined. Henrik, name one. Name one.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
There isn't one.
Yeah, it's even what goes around in Hollywood at the time, and what, you know, what's happening there with the infiltration, and plenty of people at the time, you know, were being sentenced for being communist spies, and yet, you know, in hindsight now in history, people, you know, repeat that footage of you know, McCarthy, you know, and kind of laughing at it like it's, there was nothing to it, you know, and it's very, it's a very one-sided view of history, let me put it that way.
Well, the Soviets were smart enough to understand the power of movies, the power of communications, and they used infiltration of the unions, the electricians union, the stagehands unions, the theatrical unions, to try to have an effect on the studios and to try to get movies that showed a more benign and friendly view of the Soviet Union. This is all historically documented. The idea that Ronald Reagan was some kind of lunatic because he was trying to ferret out communist subversion in the motion picture industry in the 40s and 50s is nonsense. Reagan was correct. There was a concerted effort to try to make inroads into the control of mass media at the time.
Yeah, indeed. What about the claim that Henry Kissinger was a Soviet spy? What do you make of that?
Well, Kissinger is a fascinating and extremely duplicitous figure in this entire time. Recognize that in 1968, Henry Kissinger is on the payroll as the full-time foreign policy advisor of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, Nixon's great political arch rival. At the same time, Kissinger is a paid consultant to Lyndon Johnson's State Department, and by night, he is moonlighting, writing memos to Hubert Humphrey, who would like to be president, advising Humphrey on how to skewer Nixon's foreign policy positions. Kissinger knows that Nixon holds him in low regard because Kissinger has told anyone who will listen that Nixon is an idiot. Then, when Kissinger learns that Lyndon Johnson is going to call a bombing halt in the Vietnam War, 5 days before the 1968 election, which, by the way, is a naked political ploy. He has no agreement from the North Vietnamese or the South Vietnamese or the National Liberation Front to come to the table. It's a ruse. It's politics wrapped up in national security. Liberals correctly say that Nixon used back channels to sabotage potential peace talks. The key word is potential. The war would not have ended in 1968. No lives would have been saved. This was not treasonous. It was high-level brinkmanship. It was politics. The grocer's son from Southern California outmaneuvered Lyndon Johnson, who had stolen the 1960 election from him. It was payback. And it didn't prolong the Vietnam War. Johnson was holding nothing. It was a ruse. Why end the bombing 5 days before the election? Why not 5 months before the election?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Kissinger learns this. He passes the word through William F. Buckley Jr., Bill Buckley, the only person that he and Nixon have in common as a friend. By giving Nixon the heads up, the tip off, he ensures his role in Nixon's foreign policy apparatus. Nelson Rockefeller, in order to control policy, is all too happy to let Dick take his chief foreign policy advisor. So, and as I indicated, the Central Intelligence Agency believed that that Kissinger was an active communist agent. In fact, Kissinger is for Kissinger. The reason that Nixon never destroys the tapes that hung him, the tapes that destroyed him, the so-called White House tapes, where he was surreptitiously taping every phone conversation and every meeting, is because those tapes are his protection against Henry Kissinger. He knows that after his presidency, Kissinger will try to take credit for the opening to China. By the way, Kissinger was opposed to the opening of China.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that Kissinger will take credit for the arms control agreements with the Soviets. He knows Kissinger will take credit for the ending of the Vietnam War. The reason he keeps the tapes is to prove that it is Nixon who is the strategist. It is Kissinger who is the implementer, not the other way around.
Now, tell us about the pardon and what happened here, because it's, you know, it's an interesting story how this unfolded in terms of, you know, Gerald Ford gets in there, and there's a lot of things that I guess they're just basically trying to prevent from unfolding a potential, political disaster that would kind of shatter America's political system. Is there a reason behind the pardoning of Nixon here?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunately far more venal. In essence, what happens is once it becomes clear that Nixon has taped all of this conversation, there now exists a record of the cover-up, and that's the beginning of the end for Nixon. So things fall apart very quickly. He goes from winning the greatest electoral majority in American history at that point in 1972, beating his opponent in 49 out of 50 states, to being driven from Washington, you know, a year and a half later. He probably would have survived had he destroyed the tapes, but he didn't destroy the tapes for the reasons we discussed. There's some evidence that he actually gave the order to destroy the tapes, or at least to sort through them, to sort out the foreign policy stuff that he could use to protect himself and destroy the rest, but that just never happened, and therefore he is driven from office. Now, Nixon realizes that he's probably going to be prosecuted and sent to prison. And therefore, I believe Vice President Spiro Agnew is shuttled out of the way because he won't pardon Nixon. They drive him from office based on some trumped-up charges of financial irregularity. He ultimately only pleads to a minor tax charge. He serves no punishment for it. He writes in his own book that the Central Intelligence Agency set him up, that the whole thing was a fraud. And Nixon very carefully picks Gerald Ford. Not Ronald Reagan, not Nelson Rockefeller, not Barry Goldwater, but Gerald Ford. Why? Because Ford is a man on whom Nixon has leverage. Nixon knows that as a member of the Warren Commission, Congressman Gerald Ford is responsible for altering the autopsy records of John F. Kennedy at the request of J. Edgar Hoover, moving the description of the bullet in Kennedy's upper left back to his lower neck in order to accommodate the government's so-called single bullet theory. Now, we know this to be an absolute fact because the autopsy itself would be declassified in 1987, and the New York Times and Associated Press would both report Ford had altered the autopsy in his own handwriting. Nixon knew this in 1974, and therefore he dispatches his chief of staff, General Alexander Haig. There's a lot of evidence that Haig is himself a double agent, really working on behalf of the hardliners at the Pentagon to get Nixon out of office, mm-hmm. but at the same time working to broker a deal so that Nixon will keep his mouth shut. He goes to Ford on August 1st, 1974. He arrives at Vice President Ford's office, and he finds that Ford is accompanied by one of his aides, Robert Hartman. Haig won't talk in front of Hartman. He leaves. 3 hours later, he circles back for a private one-on-one meeting with Ford, and he says, "Look, Jerry, if Nixon's going down, he's taking everybody with him. You, he knows what you did in Dallas. He's going to talk about it at the trial. The CIA, their involvement with Kennedy, he's going to lay it all out. So if he's going down, he's taking everybody with him." It is absolutely clear from August 1st, 1974 forward that Ford has decided to pardon Nixon, to silence him, because he will spill all the dark secrets of the American government. And he's been at the table for long enough to know the dark secrets. So Nixon, I think, was of mixed minds. He kind of wanted to go to trial because he was going to lay it all out. At the same time, he wasn't interested in serving any time in jail. So he blackmails, in essence, Ford for a pardon. Ford pardons him, which probably costs Ford his 1976 reelection against Jimmy Carter. Of course, Nixon then goes on to write 10 best-selling New York Times best-selling foreign policy books, and ironically emerge later as a key foreign policy advisor for President Bill Clinton during the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the tumultuous events in China. So Nixon is nothing if not the ultimate survivor. He is a survivor, and of course, four American presidents attend his funeral. President Bill Clinton gives the eulogy at Nixon's funeral, and he says, "Let the days of judging Richard Nixon on anything other than his entire record be past." It's really the point of my book. Let's look at the whole man, the mistakes as well as the achievements. It's a stunning and fascinating story, a Greek tragedy, if you will. He's a tragic figure, but he's a compelling and interesting figure, and he's the most dominant figure in American politics in my lifetime.
It's just one long string of corruption, really. There's no break. One event takes over after the other, and it's amazing when we go back in history and view it like that and realize that that's really how it's laid out. But wouldn't that be something if Nixon decided in some capacity to speak out on even on his own? I mean, did he talk anything more about this? Because, I mean, it seems to me that if he held this, possibility of being able to take so many people down, that's another reason, I guess, why he would be, so much demonized of the way of kind of preemptively trying to discredit him in a way. Did he ever speak about this in any capacity?
He was not a very retrospective or introspective individual. I spent a lot of time with him, a lot of time alone with him. And after he had a couple cocktails, he could become loquacious and more forthcoming. But generally speaking, he was more interested in the future than the past. I mean, I had the privilege in his post-presidential years of being an advisor, carrying a lot of messages for him, doing soundings politically around the country, passing messages. I passed a number of handwritten memos between Nixon and President Reagan during Reagan's time, and also messages from Nixon to President George H.W. Bush, whom, by the way, Nixon never had a terribly high regard for. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that he had a low regard for him. But George H.W. Bush's father, Prescott Bush, who was a senator from Connecticut and before that an international banker, played a very key role in Eisenhower's decision to take Nixon as vice president in 1952. So Nixon had a long-term loyalty and appreciation for Prescott Bush, and therefore he gave George H.W. Bush, who really kind of bombed out in his political career after losing two U.S. Senate races in Texas, a series of appointed jobs that would keep Bush's presidential prospects and his political career alive. So the entire question of Bush's role, not only in the Kennedy assassination and the Central Intelligence Agency, the Bay of Pigs, but Bush's role in Watergate. I mean, the Watergate burglars are arrested with $10,000 in cash on them, and those bills are traced to a Mexican bank where money from George Bush's inner circle had been laundered for the Watergate burglars. So for, Bush is not an innocent bystander in any of this historical narrative.
No.
Down the road, I'm working on a book now on the Bush family. I will make a compelling case that the Bushes tried twice to remove Ronald Reagan as president. First, in the assassination attempt, John Hinckley is very, very traceable to the Bushes and to the Central Intelligence Agency. That has never been properly explored. And when that didn't work, they tried to set set Reagan up in Iran-Contra. George Bush says, I was out of the loop. He wasn't out of the loop. He was running the loop. All of these shady drug figures involved in Iran-Contra are all associates of George H.W. Bush. So Bush had seen Kennedy removed in a coup d'etat. He had seen Nixon removed in a coup d'etat. And he thinks his best chances of becoming president are to remove Ronald Reagan in a coup d'etat.
Yeah. Well, Roger Stone, we're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, and then we're going to pick up after the break. I have a lot more questions for you, not only about the, Nixon's scenarios and everything that occurred around him, but also the future. I want to ask you more about that, America's politics and your own role in the libertarian alternatives, etc. A lot more about that. But tell us more about the book, where people can go to pick up copies of it. Please let us know if there's any, website or Twitter account feeds or anything like that you'd like to give out to our audience as well.
Sure, you can go to nixonssecrets.com, one word, no apostrophe, nixonssecrets.com. There's a lot of information about the book. There's a photo gallery there. There's links where you can purchase the book. There's a number of articles that have been written about it. You can go to Facebook, where there's a Facebook page for Nixon Secrets. You can also go to amazon.com or to barnesandnoble.com. My book on Lyndon Johnson and on the Kennedy assassination has just come out in paperback, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, with two new chapters and an extensive afterword. I kind of recommend reading that book first because my book on Nixon is in many ways a sequel. These parts all fit together, same cast of characters. Let me give you the most staggering statistic. Of the six Watergate burglars, five of them are on the ground in Dealey Plaza. On November 22nd, 1963, those four men are also at the Bay of Pigs invasion. Those four men are also involved in the Kennedy assassination, the Castro assassination plots. So whether it's George Bush or whether it's Frank Sturgis, history is the same series of characters who keep popping up again in the Kennedy assassination Watergate. Same people. This is not a coincidence.
Oh, surely not. Absolutely. All right, well, the books here then, if you want to read them in chronological order, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, and then the one we've been talking primarily about here today so far is Nixon's Secrets, The Rise, Fall, and Untold Truth About the President, Watergate, and the Pardon. The website is nixonsecrets.com. We'll have that up on our websites as well. All right, well, we'll take a short break here, Roger. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Hey kids, I'm the clown.
We'll proceed with the second hour right after this break. We have much more to discuss with Roger Stone, and we'll not only talk more about the JFK assassination and Nixon, but we'll get into recent politics as well and discuss the upcoming 2016 election in America, the Libertarian Party, the prospect of getting a Libertarian candidate on the ballot. We'll discuss the changing demographics in America and the Republican response to this, as both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are getting more and more similar as they try to go for the same voters. As they do this, of course, more exclusion is going to take place, and there's a number of different scenarios that might arise from this, not only a third party, but even down to the fact that there might be secession in America. We'll talk more with Roger about that. So, more is coming up. Please join us at redicemembers.com for much more. Go there, sign up, and tune in. We have some good guests for you lined up as well. Brian Hooker on the CDC whistleblower and the autism vaccine link. We also have Arthur Topham, Daniel Hammarberg, Jason Erb, Neil Kramer, Carlos Morales, and also Lawrence Eastman. We'll talk to you on the other side of this break. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us for more.